5 days, it has been seven if you count last weekend. Our look back at the week that was. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Reznov. Friday, the 27th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are, as of this afternoon, 1 week into Donald Trump's economy. It has been busy, I guess you could say, at the White House and elsewhere. So here for our weekly wrap, Ornella Richardson from Redfin. Sudeep Reddy is now at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So Politico, brand new what? Editor-in-chief, right? Grand poobah, is that what you are?
An editor, yes. Well,
all right.
There we go.
Let me start with you, Mr. Editor, and ask you, we're going to jump around because there's been so much. Let's start with the past, say, 24 to 36 hours, the Mexican border standoff, I guess you would call it, and what that portends in global trade and the policies coming out of the White House.
It portends that we are in for a bumpy ride ahead. We don't actually know what's going to come out of this. We saw the Trump administration floating some ideas mm-hmm. that have been going around on how to tax imports versus exports, how to raise revenue for what was supposed to be a tax overhaul and might be to build a wall. This is a very interesting way of doing policy, of throwing things up in the air to float them and see how the public responds. It is certainly not what has been done in Washington for a long time.
But, right. But which, Neela, we should say is what the president promised to do, right? Not do things as they have been done. So just to pick up on what Sudeep said, the number that was floated yesterday was a 20% tax on not just Mexican imports, but all imports. What happens if that happens?
Well, you know, for economists, taxation is messy business. It's akin to kind of shooting yourself in the foot. And we really don't know. Now, if it's part of an entire corporate overhaul, then the idea is that the exchange rate would adjust and the effect to the American consumer wouldn't mm-hmm. be that great. If instead the Trump administration goes forward with a campaign promise to increase tariffs on Mexico and China, that could set off a trade war. And that impact would be definitely affected by the things that we import from those countries, particularly when it comes to Mexico, cars.
Right. Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Mexican thing later in the broadcast. But Sudeep, let me back us way up to, I think it was Monday morning, maybe Tuesday. Honestly, it gets blurry. One of the very first things the president did was to sign the order pulling us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So again, this is what we were promised, right?
We were promised an end to multilateralism, which has been the prevailing order for the last seven decades, not only in the United States, but for the advanced world. And what Donald Trump promised is that we will go to bilateral agreements, we'll go to a different kind of trading relationship. It's possible that that's what the world needs at this moment. Maybe we will come out of it, but it's an adjustment that most of the U.S. economy is just not positioned for right now. It's not. Companies have been globalizing for decades. They've been moving their supply chains around in a much different fashion. So to take them and shake them all right at once and say, you know what, we're going to move this entire ship really quickly and we want you to come along with us is probably not going to turn out the way a lot of people in the Trump administration are hoping.
So, Neela, let me ask you then, without getting too far down in the weeds, where that shaking up is likely to be felt, on the coasts, in the big cities, or in the center of the country, in the Rust Belt, where the changing economy is being felt so desperately?
If you look at the net effect of these policies, I think it hits the American consumer and the middle class right in its pocketbook. You know, what the economy needs is a greater workforce, an expanded workforce, and a more productive one. And those are two very hard things to pull off. And the question is turning to a trade war going to be helpful to the American consumer? And the answer is obviously no. And then the second thing is withdrawing from our international leadership position right. and doing these one-off agreements really going to show American strength in foreign policy? And absent that, do we increase our deal-making position?
That's a huge question here. The assumption here is that the U.S. has the power in the relationship and most of the relationships. We're the largest economy. We've been setting the rules for a while.
Yeah.
But that assumption is going to face a really big challenge right now because American workers depend on consumers elsewhere. That's how the economy has been built up for decades. And these countries will respond. They're not going to just fall over and imagine that this is the only option for them. There are other big economies, and they're going to retaliate in the same fashion. And suddenly you do end up in a race to the bottom on whether it's taxation or any other policy.
As we're seeing with the Mexican relationship right now. But Neela, let me ask you, in the half minute we have left, there's an uncertainty thing going on here, right? I mean, after the election, everybody was all happy because we knew that, you know, we were going to have lesser regulation and it was going to be a pro-business policy. And now we have, in the first week, some upset in terms of what exactly is happening.
That's right. And some things that seem in direct opposition to each other, like expanding GDP and economic growth while at the same time, you know, cutting off trading partners. So some things are not just making sense. They're not adding up. And so that uncertainty was actually expected because everybody knows that the devil is in the details.
Yep.
And when those details roll through Congress, that's when people actually figure out what's going on, and it really they can measure the cost to their pocketbooks.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. We haven't even gotten Congress involved really yet. Sudeep Reddy from Politico and Neela Richardson from Redfin. Thanks, you two.
Thanks,
Kai. Have a great weekend. Thanks.
All right, you too. On Wall Street today, it was a little mixed. Not a whole lot of up or down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. British Prime Minister Theresa May was at the White House today. There was the customary joint press conference, questions about NATO and Russia and the special relationship, and also for the president, questions about the increasingly troubled Mexican-American relationship that I alluded to, that we spoke about, really, with Sudeep and Neela. Trump said he had spoken with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto today.
We had a very good call. I have been very strong on Mexico. I have great respect for Mexico. I love the Mexican people. I work with the Mexican people all the time, great relationships. But as you know, Mexico, with the United States, has out-negotiated us and beat us to a pulp through our past leaders. They've made us look foolish. We have a trade deficit of $60 billion with Mexico.
So about that last bit there, the trade deficit, the U.S.-Mexico trade relationship gets talked about by the White House as if it's the U.S. just pouring money over the border. In point of fact, because they matter, most economists say the trade deficit with Mexico isn't really that big a deal, and that actually it is shrinking to boot. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour takes it from there.
You know that smartphone, the one you keep checking obsessively? Well, you can thank Malcolm Appelby for that.
We make the equipment that makes computer chips. So most of the chips in your phone are likely to be made on our equipment.
Appelby is logistics manager for Lam Research in Livermore, California. They are one of the companies that President Trump wants to see flourish. They are an exporter
to Korea, Taiwan, Japan, Singapore, and China, and Europe.
But in order to make their machines, they need frames from Mexico.
Everything is bolted onto the frame of the equipment. Without the frame, we can't build anything. And we're concerned about the availability of supply from Mexico.
In fact, a third of the stuff we import from Mexico, we actually use to make things that we export. If you take that into account, our trade deficit with Mexico goes down by a third. Nowhere is this intertwining of the U.S. and Mexican economies deeper than in the auto industry.
The number one thing that we export to Mexico are vehicles, followed by auto parts. And the number one thing that they export to us are vehicles and auto parts.
Noel Maurer teaches international business at George Washington University. On average, $3,500 of the value of an American-made car is in stuff that comes in from Mexico. And as a car gets assembled, some of its components travel not just once across the Mexico-U.S. border, but sometimes twice or three times.
Simple calculation is you slap a 20% tariff on imports from Mexico. The cost of making an American-made car goes up by about $700 per vehicle, up to maybe $1,300.
Beth Pride is president of BPE Global. That's a consulting firm that helps companies move items across borders. One of her clients imports car transmissions from Mexico and uses them to build cars here.
If those transmissions can't be imported at a reasonable cost and they have to make transmissions somewhere else, the cars are going to be built somewhere else.
That would cost U.S. assembly jobs. But millions of U.S. jobs also depend on cheaper consumer goods from Mexico. Duncan Wood directs the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
So, for example, if you save $100 on a washing machine, a dishwasher, you then can spend that money in your local economy, which actually creates jobs here in the United States.
So, no, the U.S. is not losing in its trade relationship with Mexico, even if we run a trade deficit. It's winning. And so is Mexico. We're both winning. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The standard caveat we ought to use when talking about an Obamacare replacement, I guess, is that we're a long way from a final Republican plan. Because, as I said this week, this stuff is complicated. But there are plenty of ideas floating around out there. One of them is to give states block grants, fixed amount of cash, to help them cover low-income people on Medicaid. Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act was optional. It helped states insure more low-income people, but it has not been a conservative favorite. Yet Michigan and its Republican governor has had some success with its program. From WDET in Detroit, Laura Herberg has the story.
Nikisha Douglas is a regular at a clinic run by Wayne State University in Detroit. Every month, she has to get a diabetes checkup there. Today, her certified medical assistant says that Douglas's average blood sugar levels are low.
It's like she's reversing, so she's going back into the non-diabetic stage.
Douglas has no doubt about what this means for her health.
That's a very good thing.
Right.
Douglas is insured by Healthy Michigan, her state's Medicaid expansion plan. She doesn't work due to a disability, so these visits don't cost her anything. Designers of the Healthy Michigan plan hope that affordable preventative care like this will lead to better health for Michiganders and drive down health care costs. The law extended coverage to individuals making roughly up to $16,000 a year. Since the plan began in 2014, more than 600,000 people have joined. In this year's State of the State address, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder touted the plan's successes, and then he acknowledged its uncertain future.
There's going to be changes in health care.
One possibility is that Medicaid will go to states as block grants. The governor said he looks forward to working with his federal partners.
We need to let them know that Healthy Michigan is a model that can work for the rest of the country.
After all, it worked for a majority Republican state legislature. Steve Fitton was the state director of Medicaid services when Healthy Michigan was signed.
It's important to note that there was a very conservative blueprint put on the Medicaid expansion in Michigan.
Fitton says one reason it won Republican backing is that coverage is not free for everyone.
What folks referred to as skin in the game.
Enrollees with incomes between about $11,000 and $16,000 a year may pay up to 5% of their income for services. Fitton says there have been a few issues with the plan, like figuring out the best way to collect payments, but mostly there have been measurable positive outcomes. Hospitals are seeing a difference. Dr. John Deletta is the Detroit-based chair for emergency medicine with Henry Ford Health System.
What we've seen is an increase in our Medicaid, statistically our Medicaid population, and a decrease in our no-pay or self-pay populations.
So now, more emergency room patients are covered by insurance. Unpaid care in hospitals across the state has gone down by about half. And Healthy Michigan enrollees are also going to their primary care physicians. But does the plan make fiscal sense for Michigan? Dr. John Iannian is the director of the Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation at the University of Michigan. His group looked into the economic impact of the program if it were to continue as originally conceived under the Affordable Care Act.
Our recent study suggests that actually the state budget comes out ahead by participating in the Medicaid expansion because of the savings to the state as well as the increased tax revenue.
But that's only if the federal government allows Michigan and other states to continue their Medicaid expansion programs. Everything would be up in the air with block grants. Nobody really knows how much Michigan might get from the federal government and how much the state might have to pay. In Detroit, I'm Laura Herberg for Marketplace.
Coming up,
people have continued to expect governments to deliver much faster economic growth than they're able to deliver.
Now, why would people think a thing like that, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Another mixed day on Wall Street. Dow Industrials gave up 7 points, less than a tenth percent, 20,000 rather, in 93. The NASDAQ ticked up 5 points, a tenth of 1%, 56.60. The S&P 500 dribbled down about a point, less than a tenth percent, 22.94. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 1.3%, the NASDAQ up 1.9%, the S&P 500 up 1%. Even Microsoft bounced up 2.3% after it wowed Wall Street with better-than-expected fourth-quarter profits. Market cap on that company now more than a half a trillion dollars. Chevron dropped 2.3% today after it reported weak results. Investors seemed to back away from oil and gas on that news. ExxonMobil drifted down about a tenth percent. ConocoPhillips lost more than 2% today. Alphabet, PayPal, and Starbucks all slipped after releasing numbers that were lower than investors had hoped. Alphabet, a.k.a. Google, slipped 1.3%. PayPal off nearly 3%. Starbucks down 4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. President Trump, as he has demonstrated this week, has a penchant for speed, for getting deals done. The federal bureaucracy, however, does not. And while the president has signed papers to get approvals for the controversial Keystone XL and Dakota Access oil pipelines going, a heretofore obscure federal agency responsible for actually approving pipeline projects is very much in the mix. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, issues pipeline permits. That is, when it has enough commissioners. In a week, it won't. See, one is about to quit after President Trump replaced him as chairman. And this halt is a mixed signal to an industry that just got a green light by the White House, its promotion of two major oil pipelines. It's odd policymaking, says Tom Seng, energy professor at the University of Tulsa.
They seem to be shooting from the hip. There's a lot of decisions thrown out there without understanding the potential ramifications, because this kind of runs counter to what just happened with Dakota Access and Keystone XL.
Several natural gas pipelines await approval at FERC, and they could wait months or more for commissioners to join. And big fights are brewing at FERC. Opponents of the president's oil and gas agenda have made pipelines a new battleground. Energy and Environment Attorney Jim Rubin is with the firm Dorsey & Whitney.
There probably will be a higher scrutiny, maybe even projects that weren't so controversial before might kind of get in the bullseye of those folks who are concerned.
This will play out in D.C. and at pipeline sites, which could present the White House with some tough choices when it comes to dealing with protests, says pipeline consultant Rusty Brazil at RBN Energy.
What happens if a construction project gets disrupted by a protest, and then what can the government then do? You can hypothesize about that as good as I can. I think it's probably best that I not.
Not with so many energy projects in the pipeline. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
All right, on to the world of politics and higher education and the politics of higher education. You want to get an argument going about higher ed, just start talking about tenure. This month, two states have introduced bills to eliminate tenure from public colleges and universities. Missouri's bill would bar tenure for new professors hired starting next year. Iowa's bill would eliminate tenure for all of its professors. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Tenure essentially provides professors who get it permanent employment. To advocates, its necessity is clear.
The primary argument for tenure is that it protects academic freedom.
Hans-Jörg Tiede is with the American Association of University Professors. He says without tenure, professors could effectively be censored if they fear getting fired for what they say.
Faculty members still are under attack for their speech, for what they say in the classroom, for what they publish and what they say in the public arena.
And there's a market argument for keeping it, too. Richard Chait is a professor emeritus of Harvard School of Education. He says if Iowa and Missouri schools didn't offer it,
it would create an enormous competitive disadvantage in the recruitment of faculty.
From his statements, I assumed he was a fan of tenure.
Actually, that's a misread. In fact, I have a rather notorious history as a critic of tenure, but I don't think the solution is to abandon the idea.
One of his critiques, it's hard to eliminate unpopular or outdated programs taught by tenured staff. Richard Vetter is an emeritus economics professor at Ohio University. He sees value in offering teachers higher pay instead of tenure, but he says fewer faculty are getting it anyway.
Tenure is declining in its dominance in higher education as an increasing percentage of faculty are hired as either adjunct or part-time faculty.
Or just without tenure. Regardless, Vetter says he'd rather not see states dictate how tenure decisions are made. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We got the number for 2016 gross domestic product growth this year, rather measly 1.6%. But being as we are at a pivot point in economic policies, we figured this would be a good time to talk about presidents and governments and how much economic influence either of them have. Mark Levinson is an economist and a historian. His most recent book is called An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Postwar Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. Good to have you with us.
Hello, Kai. Glad to be here.
How much power does a government have to drive economic growth, I guess?
In the near term, the government has a lot of power to drive economic growth. In the longer term, surprisingly little. Here's what I mean. In the longer run, the rate at which the economy grows depends mainly on the growth rate of productivity. Productivity is essentially how much output a worker can produce in an hour's work. And governments have really little control over that. They can do some things that will help in the long term. They can give us a good transportation system. They can help us have an educated workforce. But the president is not going to find a button on his desk that he can push to raise productivity. It's just not that simple.
So let me ask you then to put on your behavioral economist hat as opposed to historical economist hat and ask this question. Why do people put so much faith in government to improve the economy?
We had a period after World War II when the economies not only of the United States but of all of the advanced countries grew faster than at any time before or since. And, of course, governments claimed the credit for that. We had economists saying, hey, we now have the expertise with fancy tools like computers and linear programming. We can assure fast growth and low unemployment forever. And then it all went bust. And people have continued to expect governments to deliver much faster economic growth than they're able to deliver.
Do me a favor and help me understand this sort of part of the economic growth equation. We, you know, historically have grown plus or minus 3% annual gross domestic product growth year over year. More recently, it's been 1%, 1.5% average growth. What does that translate into for the folks actually living out there in the economy? What does that mean?
If you've got 3% economic growth a year, that means that on average, a person's income is going to double in the space of probably 23, 24 years. Okay, if the economy is growing at 1.5% a year, it's going to take 50 years for people's incomes to double. So you understand why people are upset about this. People would like to see their living standards rising steadily. People would like to feel that their children are going to have it better than they will. When the economy is growing a percent and a half a year, it's a lot harder to see that.
So what does it look like then in the first couple of three-ish years of a Trump administration with the headline numbers being really nice for the economy, right? Full employment and low inflation, but with growth that is not where we want it to be.
What I think we're going to see here is that we will get some initial boost in economic growth. But whether we will have faster productivity growth is really an entirely different question. There are a number of things that people talk about, reducing regulations, for example, making it easier for banks to lend money, things like that that might have some effect on productivity, or they might not. These things really can't be foreseen.
Mark Levinson is an historian. He's an economist as well. His most recent book on the topic at hand is called An Extraordinary Time. It's about economic growth after the Second World War. Mark, thanks very much.
Guy, thank you.
This final note on the way out today, it's a couple of days old, but hey, it's been a busy week, right? Tostitos, the chip maker, in partnership with Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Uber, has a new product out. It's a chip bag that when you blow into it, has a sensor that will turn a special logo on the bag, either green if it doesn't detect alcohol, red if it does. Comes with an Uber discount code as well, which is great, honestly. But a word here, if I might. If you somehow feel the need to blow into a Tostitos bag to see whether you should drive, don't drive. Come on, man. All right, we are out of here on a Friday. The Dow gave up 7 points today, less than a tenth percent, 20,093 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 5 points, about a tenth percent, 5,660. The S&P 500 down a point, less than a tenth percent, up all the way around for the 5 days gone by on Wall Street. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. Around these parts, I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we will see you on Monday. Let's do it all over again, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.